Hare Krishna. So we are going to start with the 15th chapter now. Now we have exactly 150 verses remaining. 20 in this chapter, 24 in the next chapter, 28 in the 17th chapter, that is 72 verses, and 78 in the last chapter. So we are on an average doing 7 verses per class. That was the original target when we planned with completing the Gita in 100 hours. So I am leaving from here on 26th morning. We will need for 150 verses, we will need around 22 classes. So we have around almost like more than 11 working days we have. So we should be able to complete it. So we won't have a class tomorrow, Saturday, but we should be able to complete adequately. By 23rd or 24th only we should be able to complete it. Okay. So are any of you feeling that I'm going very fast? Well, only 13 chapter, the last part I took a little fast, because that was, I felt most of the concepts I had covered, and going too deep into the concepts would not have been relevant at this level. So actually the Bhakti Shastri, according to Srila Prabhupada's original plan, was not the only forum for studying Bhagavad Gita. The Bhagavad Gita is studied at Bhakti Shastri, then again it is to be studied at Bhakti Vaibhav, and then again it is to be studied at Bhakti Sarvabhauma. That was the scheme, but currently when a Bhakti Vaibhav is held, it primarily focuses on study of Bhagavatam only. Can't hear me? Hare Krishna. Okay. So, what we are doing is, we are studying Bhagavad Gita quite deeply, but we can't go too much into the depth. So, in this time when I'm taking the Bhagavad Gita, I'm focusing primarily on the verses and understanding the concepts taught in the verses as well as the flow of the Gita. So, I'm not going too much into the Acharya's commentaries and focusing only on those parts which help us to directly understand the verse and the related verse concepts. So let's start with the 15th chapter now. When we spend more time on a verse, see, basically, yeah, correct. See how it is. Have all of you studied the 12 aims of Shastric study at the start of your course? No. Anyway, the VT is Vaishnava Training Education. They have designed 12 aims of Shastric study. So there is personal application, there is preaching application, there is theological application, there is faithfulness to parampara. Like that, there are 12 different aims. So what I focus on is either the relevance of a particular verse to our tradition or our personal application or our preaching context. So wherever a verse or a theme is relevant in that way, that means, you know, see, we are at a junction basically. So we are connected with our tradition, we want to understand our tradition better, we want to link, we want to internalize the Krishna consciousness better, and we want to be able to better equip to present it to the others. So actually these are the three connections that any practitioner needs to have. Connection with the tradition, connection with the world, and a connection in the heart. So that connection in the heart happens to application. Connection with the tradition happens with understanding the tradition, and connection with the world happens by understanding what is the contemporary ethos, what are the way people are thinking right now. So these are my three primary thrusts. So depending on whichever verse is relevant, for example, I spend a lot of time on Rajasastu Phalam Dukkham. So 14th chapter was more on, say, connecting with the world and connecting inwards. 13th chapter, I felt it was mostly understanding how those verses are connected with our traditional understanding of Chintya Bheda Veda. So that I felt was didn't need too much time. So that's why some places I spend more time. Yeah, it's more or less, I don't plan the classes to the T. But overall, I have an idea of what I'm going to speak. And generally, planning the classes completely takes off the spontaneity. Then we can't have question answers and we can't have discussions based on what is most relevant for the classes. So let's start with 15th chapter. Sri Bhagavan Vacha. Urdhvamulamadha Shakham. Ashwattham prahuravyayam, Ashwattham prahuravyayam, Chandam siyasya paranani, siyasya paranani. Yastam vedas vedavet, yastam vedas vedavet. So, this is quite an enigmatic verse in the Gita. Enigmatic means puzzling. So, urdhva moolam adha shakam. There is a tree whose roots are upwards, urdhva, and shakam are adha, downwards. The branches are downwards. And ashvattham prahuravyam. This is almost like an imperishable tree. And chandamsi yasya paranani. So, chanda refers to the Vedic hymns. Paranani, the leaves of these are the Vedic hymns. And yastam veda sa vedavit. One who knows this is the knower of the Veda. So, one significant point in this verse is the imagery, and the second is the usage. Imagery means the idea of an upside down tree. We don't see such a tree in nature. Now, Krishna doesn't explicitly say in this verse that this world is a reflection of the spiritual world, and that's why it's upside down. That's implied over here. So, this verse is sometimes interpreted differently by different people. But essentially, the point is Krishna is talking about something which is obverse. Obverse means reverse, which is not normal. So, that is the idea of an upside down tree. That is the imagery. The imagery has several significant points. It is avyaya. So, normally we know material existence is not avyaya. It is not imperishable. But why does Krishna use the word avyaya? Because although matter and material forms are not eternal, the material existence continues on. It may become manifest, it may become unmanifest. When a person comes to a jail, the person's stay in that jail is temporary, but the jail itself continues to exist. So avyayam, Krishna will later on talk about how you have to cut off. Asanga shastrena drudhena chitva. So we'll talk about it. So obviously, if you have to cut it off, then that doesn't kill the tree. That cuts off our bondage, the tree. So avyaya indicates that this world will forever continue to exist. Now, one time Srila Prabhupada gave a very strong lecture about the illusion of sex pleasure. And then after that, somebody asked Prabhupada, he said, Swamiji, he says, if everybody gives up sex and becomes monk like you, then how will the world go on? So Prabhupada replied, there will still be enough fools like you who will make it go on. So Prabhupada could be quite blunt at times. So the point is that when Srila Prabhupada talks about the illusion of sex pleasure, that he doesn't expect, and it never happens, that people will give up sex pleasure entirely. The idea is there is a difference between sexuality and sexualization. Sexuality is a part of all living beings. You know, that is a natural biological feature. And that is a biological mechanism. Prabhupada writes in the 10th chapter of the third canto, the 10 sections of the phases of creation. He says that human beings are more passionate than animals. Although we normally say animals are in ignorance, human beings may be a slightly higher. He says they are more passionate because the human sexual drive is not regulated. Animals have their reproduction, copulation at specific times, specific seasons. But in humans, it is all the more unregulated. So why is that? Because humans have a more developed consciousness by which they want more happiness. We strive for more happiness, and then when we strive for more happiness, we actually are meant to strive for that greater happiness at the spiritual level. But when we don't know about the spiritual level, we try to get more happiness at the material level. And that's why, you see, how many animals suffer from obesity because of overeating, or they suffer from digestive order just because of improper eating? They don't. Because, you know, for them, although they also get pleasure in eating, sleeping, mating, defending, their behavior is more or less controlled by the instincts that they have. It's governed by the body which they have, practically speaking. They have some free will, but not much. Human beings, we have the capacity to experience higher happiness, but instead we use that developed consciousness to try to get more gratification at the bodily level. So what has happened in our modern culture is everything has become sexualized. Sexualized means that the advertising, the culture, the dressing, the talking, you know, people make jokes, and people, when they speak, they have innuendos. Innuendos means, you know, implied jokes, that sort of thing. So everything has become sexualized in today's culture. So sexuality is a natural part of biology. It has its part in psychology. It's a part of nature. But sexualization means bringing sexual meaning and sexual thoughts into everything. If somebody has to advertise a CD, now there is no need to put the CD in the mouth of a female with lipstick and show it that way. The CD is just an object for data transfer. But through this kind of advertisement, the CD becomes sexualized. So the problem in modern culture, it's not that Vedic culture is prudish in denying sexuality. No, sexuality is a part of life, and that is very much there. So a few people may become monks and try to go beyond the sexual urge completely. For most people, there is grihastha ashram. But the point is, actually in modern society, things go far beyond the indulgence in the sexual urge to the sexualization of everything. So, as I said, people talk, walk, everything is filled with sexual overtones. And that is counterproductive. So, when Srila Prabhupada speaks about this way, he's pointing, because Srila Prabhupada himself included grihastha ashram. He was a grihastha and he included grihastha ashram. So, it's not that Vedic culture is against sex per se. That's a part of human biology. The only thing is, there is over-infatuation with that in our culture. And that over-infatuation can go both ways. One way is that, you know, people just constantly think about it. And the other extreme that is there in some conservative cultures is just don't think about it, don't talk about it. Just, it's as if, pretend as if it, that part of life doesn't exist only. Many times when people get introduced to ISKCON and they read Prabhupada's books and they find so much about sex in Prabhupada's books. It's just a sadhu, why is he talking so much about sex? So actually that is education, and we shouldn't get too obsessed about it. So rather than completely sort of denying the whole part and pretending that that part doesn't exist in life, or making that part as the essence of life, we understand this is one part of life. So modern culture has this sexualization which has become an obsession, and that is undesirable. So the jail will go on its own. It's not that the prisoners have to worry, oh, if I leave the jail, what will happen to the jail? That is stupidity. The prisoners should think, how I can get out of the jail? There are other people who will take care of the jail. So now Krishna also uses the word Ashwatha. Now Ashwatha, Srila Prabhupada translates as a banyan tree. The word Ashwatha has multiple meanings in Sanskrit. Basically, it refers to some tree of the fig branch. So now Ashwatha also means Ashwatha. Ashwa is horse, tha is to be situated. So Chakravarti Pada explains that Ashwatha, a horse often stands on three legs. He just raises one leg and stands on three legs. So he says like that, actually this world is called Ashwatha and it's upside down, because this world is only, is like the one leg which is up. You know, when a horse stands on three legs, the one leg that is suspended, that leg is a little uncomfortable. So like that, this world is an uncomfortable place to be in. So it is ekapada vibhuti, and the remaining tripada vibhuti is in the spiritual world. So just as the horse has four legs, three legs are on the ground, one leg is in the air. So like that, three parts of the existence are in the spiritual world. They are stable, they are eternal, they are joyful, they are Vaikuntha. Whereas this one part which is suspended, it is Kuntha, it is filled with anxiety. So Srila Prabhupada says that if somebody catches you, ties you up and puts you upside down, he suggests that you will be miserable, since this whole material existence is like being put upside down. So this is the imagery. Urdhva Moolam Adha Shakham. And then the second part is the usage. See, Krishna uses a little paradoxical usage. He says that Chanda is Parana. The Vedic hymns are the leaves. But then he says, one who knows the full tree is Vedavit. not one who knows the chanda, one who knows the leaves is Vedavit. That means that just by knowing the Vedic rituals or the Vedic verses, one doesn't become the knower of the Vedas. The Vedas are a broad body of knowledge that is not just restricted to the hymns or the rituals that are talked about in the hymns. It is a complete body of knowledge which gives us understanding of the whole material world and the spiritual world. So Krishna will talk about, now he's talking about the word Vedavit, he will talk about what is the purpose of the Vedas. It is not just to recite the Vedic hymns. It is, in 15.15 he will tell, Vedaischa Sarvair Aham Eva Vedyo. So the purpose of the Vedas is to know him. That's why the Vedic hymns are one part of this tree, that is the leaves. But the knower of the Vedas is not just the knower of the leaves, but the knower of the whole tree. That means the knower of the predicament of the conditioned soul and the knower of the way to come out of that predicament. No. Adhashchordvam prasruta tasya shakha. Gunapravruddha vishaya pravala. Gunapravruddha vishaya pravala. Adhashyamulanyanusantatani. Adhashyamulanyanusantatani. Karmanubandhini manushyaloke. Karmanubandhini manushyaloke. So, Krishna is telling, okay, somebody might think this is upside down trees there. But these things are not so simple. He says some branches also grow upwards and some roots also grow downwards. So adhascha urdhvam prasruta tasya shaka. So its branches are moving in all directions. And then downwards and upwards. And then guna pravruddha vishaya pravalaha. Guna pravruddha means it flourishes by the effect of the moods. So now what is he referring to by branches going upward and downwards? If this is the root. The root is Satya Loka, Brahma Loka, from where this whole material creation expands. And just as when the creation grows, it grows from up to below. In the sense that, first, see, modern science has the concept of evolution. First, there was simple, and from simplicity, complexity came. Whereas the Vedic concept is of devolution. First, the original was most complex. Brahmaji is the most intelligent among all living beings. And then from there, other living beings emerge. So, from that root, Brahmaji is the first created being within the universe. And he created the rest of the universe and then other living beings appear. Now, those living beings who are in this creation, they within the universe can go up or go down. Depending on their karma. That Krishna talked about in 14.18. Urdhvam gacchanti sattvastho madhya tishtanti rajasa jaganya guna vittista adho gacchanti tamasa. So when he's saying about some branches go up, some branches go down, he's referring to the way living entities move up and down and the way they create their destiny. So the branches of this tree refer to, now when we're talking about living, the branches of the tree, when living entities act based on their actions, their trajectory within the universe changes. They may go up or may go down or stay wherever they are. So that's what he refers to. Adhascha urdhvam prasruta tasya shakha. Some paths within this universe, see, if somebody is on Martya Loka, then if he follows the path of Punya, then he will go to Swargaloka. If he follows the path of Pap, he will go to Narak Loka, lower planets. So that's what it means. Adhascha urdhvam prasruta tasya shakha. So within this creation, some branches go up, some branches go down. And what causes the growth of these branches? Guna pravruddha. Somebody cultivates goodness, the person will move up. Somebody cultivates ignorance, the person will go down. Guna pravruddha. Vishaya pravala. So pravala is referring to twigs. So actually, when the branches, see, there is a main trunk. From the trunk, branches come. From the branches, small branches are called as twigs. And on the twigs we have leaves and then we have flowers and we have fruits. So Vishaya Pravalaha, he is saying that the twigs are the leaves. That means in this tree, where is it growing ultimately? Every tree, for example, the normal trees grow towards the sunlight. That's where they want to get energy for photosynthesis. So he's saying the tree of material existence basically grows towards the sense objects. The twigs are growing, the twigs are sense objects. That means people in this world are seeking sense gratification. Shankaracharya and Lakshmi Narasimha Karavalamba Sutra says, Samsara vriksha agabijam ananta karma shakhayutam karana patram ananga pushpam aruya dukkha falilam patitam dayalo Lakshmi Narasimha mamadehi karavalambam. So he says, Samsara vriksha, this whole world is like a tree, a huge tree. Aghabijam ananta karma. Aghabijam. Agha is like, we have aghasura. Agha is sin. So sin is the bija of this tree. That sin is what sort of talked about in 13.22. Purusha prakriti stohi bhungte. That is our enjoying mentality. Samsara vriksha aghabijam ananta karma shakhayutam. So the ananta karma, the unlimited activities that a soul performs, they are the shakha. By the activities, the shakhas are created. The branches are created by the activities. Shakha yutam ananta karma samsara vriksha ghabijam ananta karma shakha yutam karna patra mananga pushpam. So, there is some small differences are there in the metaphor. Karna patram. So, he says karna is senses. The senses are the leaves. And ananga pushpam. Ananga is kamadev. The sense gratification, basically. Pushpam. So when the tree grows, it gives fruit. It gives flowers. The flowers are the sense objects of Cupid. But then he says, I very enthusiastically climbed up the tree. Aruya dukkha falilam patitam dayalo. Aruya, I climbed up this tree, and what did I get? Dukkha falilam. The fruit of this tree is dukkha. And therefore, patitam dayalo, I become very fallen in chasing this fruit. Therefore, he's asking Lord Narasimha Dev, Lakshmi Narasimha Mamadehi Karavalambam, please rescue me from this material existence. So this is a metaphor which also comes in, this metaphor is more elaborately developed in the second chapter of the 10th canto, where its second chapter is the Devastava. The Stava Istuti, that is, the demigods offer prayers to Lord Krishna, who is in Devaki's womb. So that time, there are several verses which talk about this tree of material existence. And then, Adhashchamulanyanusantatani. So some roots also grow downwards, he's saying. And then, Karmanubandhini Manushyaloke. So in this Manushyaloka, people become bound by their karma. And now Arjuna gets a question. This looks, sounds like a very complicated tree. You are saying some branches go up, down. Can you explain this a little bit more to me? So Krishna explained, this is not explainable. He says, it can't be explained. As I discussed earlier, don't figure it out. Get out. That's what Krishna will tell here also. Narupamasyeha tato palabhyate. Thopalabhyate. Nanto na chadir na chasam pratishtha. Nanto na chadir na chasam pratishtha. Ashwatthamenam suvirudhamulam. Thamenam suvirudhamulam. Asanga shastrena drudhena chitva. Asanga drudhena chitva. Tataha padam tat parimargitavyam. Padam tat parimargitavyam. Yasmin gatana nivartanti bhuyaha. Tameva chadyam purusham prapadye. Yata pravritti prasruta purani. So, narupamasyeha tathop upalabhyate. Upalabhyate means to be understood. Narupamasyeha. In this world, you cannot understand this form. What? Why is it not understandable? Because it is so big. Nantona chadena chasampatishtha. Where is the beginning? Where is the end? Where is its foundation? Now, where was this hugeness talked about earlier in the Gita? 11th chapter. Isn't it? Nantam na madhyam na punas tavadim. I don't know where is your middle, where is your beginning, where is your end. So, it's more or less the same thing. This tree is also representing the universe. And the rupa, Virat Rupa, is also representing the universe. So, both are huge. So, actually, the universe in and of itself is not infinite. It is finite. But from our perspective, the universe appears infinite. I say, for us with a tiny intelligence, to even understand how great the universe is and how it works, it's impossible. Scientists may understand more and more about the mechanism by which the universe works, but there is a limit to how much we can understand. Because the universe is not just a work of engineering, it is also a work of art. What is the difference between a work of engineering and a work of art? See, work of engineering, basically you try to analyze it. Okay, this computer is there. What is it made up of? Okay, there is this component, this component, this component. We break the device to be studied into its component parts. And when we understand each of the component parts, then automatically we build up and understand this is how the function works. And once I have understood the machine, I have understood it. So basically, an engineering product may be doing some extraordinary functions, but if we break it down into its individual parts, all the parts are doing something which is familiar and ordinary. But when combined together, they do something extraordinary. On the other hand, in a work of art, actually we take something familiar and imbue it with some extraordinary meaning. When there is poetry, it's not that the secret of poetry is not based on using some word which nobody has heard. Poets generally use familiar words, but the way they use it and the meaning that they convey through it. Actually, there are, you know, people who say study Shakespeare's works or other poets' works. You know, sometimes people find multiple layers of meaning within the poetry. Okay, if you see it this way, it means this. Then you go deeper and you find this means. That's what actually happens now. Bhagavad and Bhagavad are also poetry. This is, of course, there is infinite meaning in this because this is the word of God. But the work, so science proceeds by demystifying things. Things appear mysterious, but we demystify them. Okay, try to understand how it works. So science demystifies the unfamiliar, whereas art mystifies the familiar. Okay, these words are familiar, but what do they mean over here? This looks so amazing. What does it mean? So what happens is, science can understand the creation only up to a particular limit. Because Krishna is not only just expressed his engineering expertise over here, Krishna has also expressed his artistic expertise over here. So that's why the more scientists understand, what happens is, they find there is much more still to understand. You go and understand a particular theory and this looks so good. But then, in science they find that every answer raises many more questions. And we find the answers to those questions and then it raises further more questions. So, that's because we cannot get to the bottom of it all. Because the universe is not just a work of engineering. It's not that you just break it into your parts, and then we understand it. And once we understood, it's finished. It's also a work of art. And a work of art has almost endless layers of meaning with it. And the deeper we go into it, the deeper we can understand it. So Einstein's life also illustrated. Einstein, you know, one of the things he said is that the most incomprehensible thing about the universe is that it is comprehensible. What does that mean? The most incomprehensible thing about this world is that it is comprehensible. So why he said that? Because if the universe has just come about by a Big Bang, there is no need for the universe and its components to obey precise mathematical laws. Isn't it? If all the particles just exploded from some singularity, then why should all the particles in the universe obey F is equal to gm1 m2 upon r square? So why should it behave in predictable ways, and why should those predictable ways be comprehensible to us? So the most incomprehensible thing about the world is that it is comprehensible. So why is the universe comprehensible? Because it reflects the intelligence of God. And we have been given a fraction of the intelligence of God. And that's why we can understand it. But later on, in the 1940s, 1950s roughly, towards the final stage of his life, when Einstein found that the quantum theory was correct, and then he said that the quantum theory was radically in opposition to his relativity theory. So he said, everything in the universe seems to be comprehensible. It's as if the ground has been pulled from under one's feet and there is no place where one can stand. So what happened is, okay, by his scientific rational approach we understand certain things, but because the universe has multiple levels of meanings, at one particular time we stop understanding. Now if you don't understand all this, don't bother about it. What I'm saying over here is, achintya, when we say, it's not just a magic wand we blow to say that things are not explainable because we can't explain them. No, inexplicability is built into the fabric of the universe. It's not just because we can't explain things, so we use the concept of achintya. No, because it expresses the infinite intelligence in terms of artistry and engineering of the Supreme Lord, that's why inexplicability is built into the fabric of the universe. So Krishna said, don't try to understand it. It is suvirudhamulam. It is very deeply rooted. And then asanga shastrena drudhena chetva. Asanga. So asanga, what is the significance of this word? Purusha prakriti stohi bhungte prakriti jan gunan karanam guna sangosya. So the bondage has happened because of sangha. And liberation will happen by asanga. So, karanam guna sangosya was 13.22. So, asanga shastrena drudhena chitva. By asanga, cut it apart. Drudhena chitva. Determination is required. So, virudha moolam. Our material desires are deep rooted. That's why we require consistent, persistent effort to break them. And then Krishna makes a very significant point here. It's not just enough to become, to break free from material existence. After that, we have to do something. Tatah padam tat parimargitavyam. Margitavyam. We recited this, isn't it? Yeah. So, I'm just explaining it. Tatah padam, when you go there, after you attain that liberated stage, then yasmin gata anivartanti bhuya. Okay, that place is where we will not come back from. But what do you do over there? Tam eva chadyam purusham prapatti. There you surrender the Supreme Person from whom ita pravritti prasuta purani, from whom the creation has manifested. So this actually is a verse that refutes Mayavad. Because Mayavadis have the idea that just for the sake of liberation we can conceive of a person, meditate on the person, and then ultimately merge into the impersonal Brahman beyond that person. But Krishna is telling, by asanga become liberated, attain this liberated platform, and then in that liberated platform, surrender to the Supreme Person. So, tam eva chadyam purusham prapadi. Now Krishna sometimes refers to himself in the third person and sometimes he refers to himself in the first person. So now who is that Supreme Person that he has to surrender to? It's him only. So I will explain why he does that in 15.16 and 17 and 18. But let's take it through that. He's referring to himself in the third person over here. Purusham prapati, surrender to him. Now he will describe after that, okay, if I have to surrender, how do I surrender? He'll describe, so for cutting off this material existence, actually asanga shastra is there. But for surrender, what is the process? That is described in the next verse. Nirmana moha jita sanga dosha. Adhyatma nitya vinivritta kamaha. Vandvair vimukta sukha dukkha sangyair. Vimukta sukha dukkha sangyair. Vachandya mūḍā padamau vayamta. So nirmāna moha. So moha is illusion. Mana is the pride or arrogance. Nirmāna moha jita sanga dosha. So give up that pride. That pride arises from jita sanga dosha. Might arises from material association, give up that association. And adhyatma nitya vinivritta kamaha. Be always spiritually situated by which one can become free from lust. So this nivritta refers to retirement. Vinivritta refers to permanent retirement. So actually, we have to become permanently retired from material desires, especially from lust. Vinivritta kamaha. Prabhupada says in a lecture that the bond, the service to lust is like a slavery. And normally, when a person is doing some service, that person is offered some remuneration for that. And after a lifetime of service, then person is honorably retired. But when a person is a slave, if a person is a slave, there is no retirement in slavery. Till the last drop of energy is there in the person's life, the slave master, slave driver, the slave master will extract work from the slave. Similarly, you know, lust makes us labor till the last moment of our life and into our next life also. That's why actually we have to, lust will never give us retirement from it. But we have to be done with lust. That's why Prabhupada translates this Vinivritta as be done with lust. One who is, those who are done with material lust. You know, sometimes when two people have very strong disagreements and they decide that, no, we are never going to have anything to do with each other. I'm done with you. I'm done with this. I'm done with it. We're finished. Nothing more. So, Vinivritta Kamaha. And Dvandvair Mukta Sukha Dukkha Sange. One becomes equipoise, one is equality. And then, Amudha. Krishna will use the word Mudha later in 15.10. One who surrenders in this way to Krishna is Amudha. He's unbewildered. So, after describing this, now Krishna will describe what happens in that spiritual world. The overview of the chapter. So Krishna will talk about attaining liberation by detachment. I describe the upside down vanity, that's verses 1 to 6. Then, if one doesn't attain liberation, what happens to the soul? I will describe the next section, 7 to 11. That is, otherwise one suffers under bondage and liberation and transmigration. Then, when we are trapped like this in material existence, Krishna helps to liberate us. How he helps? Materially and spiritually. That is described in 12 to 15. Then, how we help spiritually and what is the essential message of the Vedic scriptures through which he helps? That is 16 to 18. That is the essence of Vedanta. That is Trishloki Gita. And lastly is that we need to know Krishna, by which we will attain liberation. To know Krishna means to know everything. We almost completed the first section. We started the second section now. You want to note this down, you can note it down.
भासयते सूर्यो न शशांको न पावकः यद्गत्वान निवर्तन्ते तद्धाम परमं मम.
So this verse talks about how a person is will attain. What will the person attain after after liberation? When we surrender to the Supreme Lord, we will attain that supreme abode. So this verse, the Acharya described that it also has some metaphorical meaning in it. So Krishna says that this place is not illuminated by the sun, then the moon, fire. So actually, sun enables us to see. Sun facilitates the capacity of sight. So, no sun refers to that place is not visible to the eye. The moon is in charge of the mind. The moon is the presiding entity of the mind. So no moon means not conceivable by the mind. And the fire is generally connected with the speech. He says he gave a fiery speech. So it refers to not describable by the tongue, by speech. So actually it is also in a sense true that in the spiritual world there is no dependence on the sun, moon or fire. The sun, moon and fire are there in the spiritual world. So Krishna's usage of word is very specific. He says, he's not saying that these are not there. He says, natad bhasayate suryo. These places are not illuminated by the sun, moon and fire. That means they are self-luminous. They don't depend on the sun, moon and fire for illumination. And Krishna will contrast this later in 15.12 with the nature of this world where yadaditya ghatam tejo jagat bhasete akhilam. This world is illuminated by sun, moon and fire. So we know that when the Rasalila is performed at a time of Sharad Purnima. That time the full moon is there. So naturally these are there. Sun, moon and fire, but there is no dependence on them. And we discussed earlier about how Srila Prabhupada includes electricity over here. Why includes electricity? Because he wants to, we know necessarily the word vidyuta over here in the translation. But remember why he includes it? Yes. Yeah, people will understand the point, yes? Every other possibility means? Okay, so electricity is inclusive for all other sources of light. That's what you think? Yes, that's true. See, both the answers are correct. Now, why include electricity? Translation has to be a balance between precision and relevance. So, precision means give exactly the words as they are given in the original book. Precise. Precise means accurate, correct. So, the translation not only has to be precise, it has to be relevant to people. So, if the relevance is not there, then people will not be able to say, okay, that's what some old book said, how does it matter to me now? Isn't it? Translation has to be precise and relevant. Prabhupada writes in the Prahlad Maharaj prayers, that one verse, Jivvaikto Achyut Vikarshati Maa Vitrupta, that the tongue is pulling me towards this and the ears are pulling me towards that. And there Prabhupada says that the ears are always attracted to hearing cinema songs. And Prabhupada says this in the translation, not even in the purport. So now somebody, a skeptic, may say that, at Prahlad Maharaj time there are no cinema songs. So what is Srila Prabhupada doing over here? Srila Prabhupada is giving us the relevant translation. The point is that all the senses are attracted to their corresponding sense objects. And when Srila Prabhupada translated, at that time cinema songs were becoming very popular in India and the West also, whatever. So now maybe if you have to give that translation, say that, okay, the ears are attracted to what? iPod music or whatever, you know. The slight difference might be there. So, Srila Prabhupada includes electricity. His point is communicating effectively to us the point that spiritual world does not require anything for illumination. So, most people don't even think of sun, moon and fire as source of illumination. They mostly think of their tube light or something as a source of illumination. Isn't it? So, people are so disconnected from nature. Many people are there in America who children, once a survey was done in school. So the children were asked, where does the milk come from? They said from the supermarket. They had no idea milk comes from a cow actually. So, like that, people just are not aware of the roots. So even materially the roots, what to speak of spiritually. You know, you turn on the switch, the light comes along. But where does the electricity come from? Electricity ultimate, all light sources ultimately are recycled electricity. It is recycled sunlight. So Prabhupada is making the translation relevant to us. And the import of this verse is that self-luminous support, if you attain it, then you will never come back. So tadgatva anivartante. And now he's connecting what was in the third person in the previous verse in the first person in this verse. He says, there you surrender to that supreme person. But he says, actually that abode is my abode only. So he brings in, for the first time in this chapter, he's introducing himself over here. Now, 7th verse onward, he talks about, okay, if you don't practice devotional service and surrender, if there is no asanga, there is no detachment, then what happens? Mamaimamsho jiva loke jiva bhuta sanatana manashashtani indriyani prakriti sthani karshati. So karshati. So actually there is akarshan and there is karshati. So Krishna is sarva akarshati iti Krishna. When we are attracted to Krishna, actually attracts everyone. But when we are not attracted to him, then there is karsh. There is this friction, grinding. So karshati is conveys the struggle in material existence. So if you see, Krishna is using very precise words: purusha prakriti stohi. And now prakriti sthani karshati. So if one has asanga, then yadgatvana nivartante. But if one continues with sanga, then that same the purusha is prakriti stohi, prakriti sthani karshati. He will struggle. Why will he struggle? Manha shashtani indriyani. Because of the mind and senses. The mind and senses keep dragging us. I want this, I want that, get that. And actually the mind and senses don't just drag us from one sense object to another. They drag the soul from one body to another, one universe to another. And like that the material existence continues on. Now, because the mind is the most formidable of all the senses, and the mind in the sense controls all of the senses, so Krishna mentions the mind separately, and he doesn't refer to 5 senses, he refers to 6 senses with the mind as the chief among the senses. And actually this verse has 2 distinct parts, and the connection between the 2 parts is interesting. One part is what Srila Prabhupada would often quote, mamaivamsho jiva loke, that the soul is my part. And this is also again a refutation of Mayavad, because the word is there, sanatanaha. He is eternally my part. He is my eternal fragment. So first 2 verses is saying that, okay, soul is my part. Second part is saying that the soul suffers in material existence due to the mind and senses. What is the connection between the 2? The connection is that if the soul doesn't act as Krishna's part, then the soul becomes controlled by Maya, by the mind and senses, and suffers. Now, either we accept Krishna as almighty. If we don't accept Krishna as almighty, if we don't serve almighty Krishna, then our mind and senses become almighty. Serving Krishna is joyful, but serving the mind and senses is painful. So manah shashtani indriyani karshati. So the first part is telling the original joyful position of the soul, and the second part is telling the artificial painful present position of the soul. That is the connection between the 2 parts. So can you read it right in the middle when the mind is in the mode of goodness? Would somebody like to read that loudly? So basically this is a paraphrase of Urdhvam Mula Madhashak. No. Urdhvam Gachindi Sattvastha. The activities are good. One goes up. Karmana Sukrutasyahu. And before that Prabhupada writes that the conditioned soul is bound up as though shackled by iron chain. So what are these chains that are binding us? They are the modes, the desires are induced by the modes. In the 16th chapter, Krishna will talk about Asha Pashashatair Baddha. The soul is bound by hundreds and thousands of desires. So, shackled by iron chains. And he is bound up by the false ego. Purusha Prakriti Stohi. So, actually, there are many specific desires that emerge. But the primary bondage between matter and spirit is due to the false ego. And once the false ego is there, After we become bound, there are so many schemes that come up. Okay, I can enjoy this, I can eat this, I can read this, I can touch this, I can see this. So where do all these ideas come from? That is the mind. So that's why Prabhupada writes, the mind is the chief agent which is driving him in material existence. The mind is the chief agent. So manah shashtani indriyani prakriti sthani karshati. The mind is the special troublemaker. And Prabhupada emphasizes Mayavad in the second paragraph by telling about how this is not a part which is temporarily partitioned. Because Sanatana means it is always a part. Any questions about this till now? Shariram yadavapnoti yachapi utkramati ishvaraha grihitvaitani sanyati Vayurgandhani Vashaya. So, Shariram Yadavapanoti. One attains the body. And Yachapi Utkramati Ishvara. Utkramati means gives up. So, the word Ishvara, Acharya explained differently. The Ishvara can be used in a sarcastic sense. Now, what kind of Ishvara is this? You know, he just gets some body which he doesn't know. And then, when he doesn't know, he has to suddenly leave the body. So what is the meaning of the, such a soul being a Ishvara? None of us choose the body that we get. You know, all of us would have wanted a stronger, healthier, more good looking body. And then none of us choose when we will leave the body. Any time, suddenly we are told. So what kind of Ishvara is it? Grihitvaitani sanyati vayurgandhani vashayat. He accepts and gives up. So as before, coming to the example of vayurgandha, the other meaning of the Ishvara is that this soul, although he is in material existence and although he's undergoing the cycle of transmigration, but the soul can determine the direction. In that sense, is Ishvara. I cannot change the body that I have got right now, but by acting properly, I can change my post-mortem destination. My destination after that. So in that sense, I am Ishvara. I can actually determine where I will go. So it's not, we are not Ishvara in terms of supreme controllers, we are minute Ishvaras. So the word Ishvara can either be in sarcastic sense or it can be in the sense that we do have some control in terms of where we will go in our life. Now Vayur Gandhan Ivashayat. So what does the soul carry from one body to another? It is the conception of life. Yam yam vapi smaran bhavanti jatyante kalevaram tam tam evaiti kaunte sada tad bhava. In the chapter Krishna talked about that. What do we attain from the next life? Tad bhava bhavita. Whatever bhava we have acquired, according to that we will attain a physical nature in the next life. So the soul essentially carries the conception that is acquired. So if the soul is living in a human body, but by repeated eating of meat, has acquired the conception that meat is very enjoyable, then nature will tell, okay, why do you, if that's your conception of life, then better that you have a body that is more compatible with that conception of life. And that's how the soul will get a lion's body or a tiger's body or some other carnivore's body. So we carry our conceptions of life. And in the Prachini Parishad section, when Narad Muni is instructing King Prachini Parishad, and there is a story of Puranjana in the 4th canto, chapter 25, 26, 27, 28. So there the main message of that Puranjan metaphorical story Prabhupada writes is that the soul has to change his subtle body. Not change in terms of replace, but change in terms of purify. So liberation is not about changing the physical body. That is something which will automatically be changed at the time of death. But that will not lead to liberation. It's only when we change our subtle body. That's why it's Krishna consciousness. When we change our consciousness, then we become liberated. So we have different conceptions, and whatever conception we acquire in this life, we'll carry to the next life. So bhakti means we change our conception from the being the enjoyer to being the servant. And without that change, we go on in cycle of birth and death. So we'll continue in the next class. Krishna will talk about this. How the mind is the center, and the mind causes, play the central role in the bondage. Thank you very much. Srimad Bhagavad Gita ki jai. Srila Prabhupada ki jai. Gaur Bhaktivinoda ki jai. Gaur Prema.